Topbed Talk.
Hello and welcome to the World Congress of Perioperative Medicine, EPCOM 2022 Topbed Talk Talks 2 session. I'm Desiree Chappell, your host, and I'm joined by Monty Myden. Hello, Monty.
Day 3 at University College London, 25th anniversary. It's good to be here with you, Desiree.
It is good to be here. It is good to be in person. Monty, our session today is a sponsored session by Edwards Life Sciences. We graciously appreciate their support for everything that we do to keep free open access medical education for the world.
Couldn't do it without them.
Couldn't do it without them. So let's dive right in. We're first going to hear from our guest. Some quick presentations. We have Dr. Nick Fletcher, Dr. Gabor Ghazali. Thank you very much. And they're going to present. We'll do some further introductions once they're finished. So, Nick, take it away.
Thanks for the invitation. I was lucky enough to be sort of invited to this group of cardiac enhanced recovery, which is really a new concept in cardiac because people used to focus on about the patient dying all the time. So I think it's been a very welcome shift to talking about patient's recovery rather than what's going to happen to the patient if things go wrong. So I'm just going to introduce this session briefly and sort of put it in context and frame my colleague Gabor's talk about HPI. So I currently work at Cleveland Clinic London, which you may or may not have heard about. It's a new institution, and we're neighbours to the Queen just over the road. I previously worked at St. George's Hospital for 20 years in the NHS. I have a conflict of interest with Edwards. I do some advisory work for them. This lecture is entirely my own content. We talked a little bit about cardiac arrest. I think you didn't see Dan Engelman. It's a really interesting story, but his father was kind of the father of fast-track cardiac anesthesia, which again was the forerunner really to the idea of enhanced recovery in cardiac surgery. And this, I like this photo because it shows the two of them operating together in the same operating theatre. And, you know, it's father and son handing on the baton. So I think that's probably quite unique. And they've also handed on sort of an intellectual stream with, you know, improving the recovery for cardiac patients. So Dan founded the Enhanced Recovery, the Cardiac Eras Society, which has done a lot of great work and really has a lot of momentum and a lot of engagement right around the world in cardiac anesthesia. And this was the publication, which came out in JAMA Surgery around 3 years ago. It's actually the most downloaded publication ever in JAMA Surgery, and that really shows the engagement and the impact the idea of enhanced recovery has had in cardiac surgery. I don't know if you can see this slide so well, but what I'm really going to talk about is goal-directed therapy, which is one of the Class 1 recommendations in the Cardiac ERAS guidelines. So the recommendation is goal-directed therapy, GDT, should be performed to reduce post-operative complications. And this has been an area of controversy, really, in cardiac surgery and post-cardiac intensive care. I actually prefer the term goal-directed hemodynamic therapy because it's not really just about fluid. It's clearly about vasoconstrictors, inotropes, and that really complex balance. And I think the immediate post-op course of these patients is the most difficult of all surgeries, really. I think, because there's a lot of confounders and there's a lot of rapid changes. But when we come down to it, it's really about optimizing that oxygen delivery to the tissues. It's about getting in early and preventing established organ dysfunction, because that early hypotension starts to establish organ dysfunction. And it's really trying to break that cycle really early, particularly in these patients. So just to talk a little bit about the science, there's probably a dearth of publications compared with non-cardiac surgery in this area. But what publications there are have really shown that GDT shortens the length of hospital stay and reduces the complication rate. And that's been clear through most of the studies and is confirmed by this as the latest meta-analysis from a Chinese group of authors. When we think about early hemodynamic instability in these patients, we think about how do we manage it. It's a different group of patients. So there's certain things that we can't really use. So stroke volume variation, which we're all used to using in non-cardiac surgical patients, we can't really use it. We certainly can't use it with an open chest. But also in the enhanced recovery sort of emphasis, it's really about waking the patient early. So they're not synchronized with the ventilator because they're all ventilated early on. There's a lot of ventilated dyssynchrony, so stroke volume variation doesn't really work. Also, you also got to think about the chest isn't a closed box in these patients. You have drains which are open to the atmosphere a lot of the time. or even on suction. So the normal conditions don't really apply in these patients. Passive leg raise, in which there's been a focus, particularly in certain quarters, also doesn't work in these patients. It's very difficult to throw a cardiac surgical patient's legs in the air. They've also, a lot of the time, they've taken all their saphenous veins and their legs are tightly bandaged. So it's certainly not validated in these patients. So we're left with the idea of fluid challenge, fluid optimization, stroke volume optimization. So really, that's all I'm going to do for my introduction. Just in terms of the cardiac arrest guidelines, the guy you just saw, Mike Grant from Johns Hopkins, is leading the second iteration of the cardiac arrest guidelines. And I know with Mike at the helm, it's going to be far more like The Godfather 2 than Titanic 2. I actually haven't seen Titanic 2, but I think it's not a film I'm going to spend much time on. So really, I think just to summarize the benefits of goal-directed hemodynamic therapy post-cardiac surgery, early optimization, prevention, early prevention of deterioration, maximizing stroke volume, producing more stable hemodynamics. The other benefit we get, this is often difficult post-cardiac surgery, is standardization of care. There's a lot of individualized care post-cardiac surgery because there is sort of a different cohort of patients. There's a very different culture compared with non-cardiac surgery, where there's, in this country, say, the surgeons are a lot more involved. I know in North America, the surgeons are very involved in post-operative intensive care. In this country, and say countries like Germany, they're very different, and that culture varies very much from country to country. So, but I think standardization is a really key thing. It frequently means less fluid is given. When we had a separate fast-track group of patients at St. George's who were managed by the cardiac surgery team, compared with using goal-directed therapy, which we did with stroke volume optimization, the individualized therapy group looked after by cardiac surgeons got far more fluid. Although, interestingly, they would always tell us we gave too much fluid. But actually, when you introduce some more objective measures and have a system and a protocol, you actually give less fluid. And again, it provides a rational basis, not just for fluid, but to escalate your vasoactive therapy, very important in these patients. And again, that potential to reduce complications and hospital stay. So we'll come back to a lot of these items in the discussion, and we'll move on to the next speaker now.
Thank you, Nick. And thanks for inviting me. It's an honor to be here. So I guess there are two focus on my presentation, and I'm going to skip some of the slides because they were covered by Nick. One of them is the early goal-directed therapy that we do at St. George's. I'm from St. George's, I work there as a cardiac intensivist and anesthetist, and how we do it. But also, I would like to cover whether we can improve that, we can actually predict the future and do step forward and introduce the hemodynamic therapy before the badness happens. I also got a conflict of interest from Edwards, which is important for this talk, but the slides are mine. So hypotension is well published in a non-cardiac surgical patient population, and it's linked with morbidity and even mortality. There's a lot of literature out there. And the more hypotension the patient goes during operation and post-operation, the more likely that they suffer some kind of morbidity or mortality. But most recently, we started to realize that it's not just the event of hypotension that is important, the dose of the hypotension that is equally important. So if you take an analog here whereby you have a threshold around 65, let's make an argument that we keep the blood pressure around 65, the mean arterial pressure, it's not just the event, but the dose you suffer as you go hypotensive. So the area under the threshold or the area under the curve, that's a new terminology, comes into the literature these days. And the other thing, you can weight that area under the threshold against the length of exposure, so the length of surgery or the length of intensive care stay. And these new terms, the AUT and the TVA, and I'm going to talk about these terms during my talk. And this is what we do at St. George's. This is our protocol. When the patient arrives to cardiac intensive care unit after cardiac surgery, regardless of their blood pressure, of their lactate, of their status, they get a cardiac output monitor on, which is uncalibrated, and we optimize their stroke volume against the estimated stroke volume until they fully optimize. Of course, we've got thresholds, not to flood them with more than 2 liters of fluid, and just look up for the CVP if it's rising or the right ventricle is failing. And if they remain stable afterwards, they're fine, they get fast-tracked and extubated. If they're not, then they get medical attention and further investigations of their hemodynamic status. This is where it's getting interesting. Can we do it better? Can we actually predict the future? And there have been multiple studies to try to make an assumption that the patient will be hypotensive after infraction or during surgery. And none of them so far has gained any momentum as just yet. But of course, artificial intelligence is at the doorstep and it's coming. And this is what happened with Edwards. They created this artificial intelligence model, the Acumen software, which basically looks at the arterial waveform and divides it into five phases and then analyzes it and creates a lot of linked data. And then this combined data becomes even more complex. It's beyond my knowledge. And altogether, it generates like 2 million of data points. And then they put it into a smart computer and analyzed it and come up with 20 odd markers that can predict hypertension in the next 5-10 minutes. And they make a kind of made-up number of it, the hypotensive predictive index, which is a number between 0 to 100. And it predicts that how likely that your patient becomes hypotensive in the next 5, 10, 15 minutes. The higher the number, the more likely. And they give you a threshold around 85. But of course, it's not just the absolute number that's important. It's also a kind of hemodynamic marker, because all it does, it analyzes the arterial waveform and tells you that the patient is using the reserves to compensate for the badness that's happening. And if they run out of reserve, then the patient becomes hypotensive. So this is what happens. The upper curve is the mean arterial pressure. The lower one is the hypotensive predictive index. And as you can see, there's a trend up here, even though the blood pressure seemingly is normal. And then the computer alarms here, and the patient gets hypotensive there. This is live data from our cohort, by the way. And the monitor gets further on and gives you a secondary picture where it kind of suggests what to do next. It doesn't just give you the number of hypertensive predictive index, but it gives you the stroke volume variation. It gives you a number for contractility, and we can talk about that later in depth, the DPDT. And it also gives you a marker, a kind of difficult to analyze marker, the EADINE, the dynamic elastance, which kind of predicts whether the patient is going to respond to fluid with blood pressure or just stroke volume. And then we can go into details in that if you guys are interested. And it has been studied. This is a group of Simon Davis from York, when they analyzed the HPI against traditional markers, and it outperforms them, predicting the future. The Dutch group from Amsterdam published an article. This is from the Cleveland Clinic, when they started to use non-invasive arterial curves and run the HPI marker on them, and it's still predictive of hypertension. Very interesting data, so you don't need an art line anymore to actually predict the future. It opens up a new discussion in the lower risk of patients. And then we start moving towards cardiac surgery. There's not a lot of data out there. This is Ranucci and his group from Italy, where they analyzed approximately 23 patients, 20 of them were cardiac patients. This is intraoperative data, and they had a different approach how they define the positive markers and the negative markers, but they still come up with a very reasonable ROC curve. This is predicting hypotension intra-op during cardiac surgery in 5-7 minutes. This group from California did a very elegant study that's saying, well, you have open chest during cardiac surgery, you've got vasoplegia after cardiac surgery, and you got a whole hemodynamics unwellness post-cardiac surgery. So HPI might not be validated on these patients because the learning phase of the HPI was in a different patient population. So this is still intraoperative data, roughly 35 patients, and they looked at the performance of the HPI before cardiac pulmonary bypass, after chest closed, chest open, and it performs reasonably well even with these conditions, but this is still intraoperative data. If you move outside from the cardiac theater and theater itself, the same Dutch group which did the non-invasive analysis did a cohort study on COVID-19 patients. And yes, the ROC curve is good, but also I wanted to show you this. As the HPI threshold goes up and up and up, the likelihood that the patient will have a hypotensive event grows, as you expected. The HYPE study from the same Dutch group was already an interventional study. So it's not just how HPI performs, but actually if you intervene based on the HPI number and you generate a protocol, then can it reduce the hypotensive events intraoperatively? And it certainly could. There's a significant difference between the TWA, the time-weighted average, so the dose of hypotension during surgery between the control group and the interventional group. And the incidence of hypotension goes down significantly, as well as the area under the curve goes down significantly. Interestingly enough, they didn't use significantly different fluid basoactive substances. They just used it in a different way, but the cumulative dose was the same. They went beyond that and they looked at the same patient population in the post-op area, in the PACU, and the HPI-driven protocol had a longer lasting effect, up to 12 hours, and the patients in the PACU area had less hypotensive events. Another group from Cleveland published much bigger data, around 250 patients, and this is a very interesting study. Again, we can talk about this. They couldn't actually find, this is non-cardiac patients population, intraoperative high-risk surgery, when they had an HPI protocol against the control protocol, and they couldn't really find a difference between the hypotensive events. But if you look at how well the protocol was written than they used, and how well they adhere to, is actually a problem here. Because on the right-hand side here, you can see that the protocol suggested to use these kind of interventions depending on the measurements. And the anesthetist adhered to these kind of interventions most of the time, less than 50%. So they didn't really follow the protocol that they created from themselves. And the other problem was that they had an option of not to do anything, even though the marker was high. One third of the cases, the protocol suggested not to intervene. So what we do at St. George's, I'm just going to show you a few things that we started to work on. But first of all, there's not a lot of data, believe it or not, on post-cardiac surgery hypotension from the intensive care. I couldn't really find it, so we actually started to look into that because that's very interesting. Is it actually important? Does it make any difference? Does it happen in our institute? Does it happen around the globe? And don't forget, I'm coming from a cardiac intensive care unit where we standard of care goal-directed fluid optimize them as soon as they arrive. And this is 100 consecutive cardiac surgical patients with a Euro score around 2.5, and most of them are male and the age of 65 on average. And on the first 6 hours, 90% of them suffer some kind of hypertension. That's very interesting. And I just put this data against it. That's the data from the California group, but that's cardiac surgery data, but that's during intraop. But the time frame is more or less the same. They used it for 4 hours, we used it for 6 hours. And as you can see, there is a lot of hypertension, so 90% of the patients do get that. The cumulative episode of all 100 patients is around 600, and each patient get it approximately 6 times in that 6 hour period. So every hour they have a hypertension period, which lasts around 5, 7, 6, you know, minutes, few minutes. So the cumulative dose of it is actually reasonable. They spent roughly an hour hypotensive during the first 6 hours. That's quite significant. And you kind of assume that after the first 6 hours, when most of them are extubated and settled and started to mobilize, they're fine, but they really not. So again, 90% of them on the second 6 hours will still have hypotensive episodes, and that's very interesting. The cumulative dose is much less, but these are more stable patients. And if you look at the outcome data linked to this, and this is still unpublished, if you look at the duration of events, that's the first 50 patients we analyzed, it somehow links with AKI. And this is postoperative data, nothing to do with the intraoperative circumstances of bypass time and surgery and blood loss. This is just pure postoperative data. If you look at the HPI, we did a retrospective analysis. This is post-cardiac surgery, 20 patients, and it performs quite well. So we went on and said we're going to liberate ourselves from the company and do our own analysis prospectively. And this is just the first 10 patients I brought here. And again, the area under the curve is pretty good. But what we found is that the threshold in our cohort was not 85, but higher, around 90, 95. And I think this is where I'm going to finish, and then we can go on and talk about it. I just wanted to let you know that the HYPE-2 study is, I think, already recruiting in the Netherlands, which is going to be a big study, a few hundred patients. cardiac HBI protocol used. And we're also planning to, we just submitted the ethical approval to do a retrospective analysis in our institute on HBI on post-cardiac surgical patients. So it's interesting, it's an evolving technology, and artificial intelligence is at the door, as I said. It's going to happen, so we better learn how to live with it. So far, it's looking reasonably well with a good ROC curve, but it needs further assessment, especially in the cardiac world. And I thank you there.
Gabor, I'm going to start with you. Tell us just a little bit more about yourself. I know you introduced yourself as an intensivist and anesthetist at
St. George's.
St. George's.
So, thank you very much. So my name is Gabor Zilahi. I work at St. George's Hospital as a cardiac intensivist and anesthetist for 5 years now. And my main interest is hemodynamic assessment and echocardiography.
And Nick Fletcher with the Institute, Cleveland Clinic, yes.
Yes, so I've been there really for about 2 years. It's a very interesting new venture in London. But I was previously in the NHS for 20 years, very much up to my neck in cardiac surgery, cardiac anesthesia and critical care. And I'm interested in all aspects of it really that can improve life for patients. And also trying to shred a lot of the dogma around it. I mean, we heard some of the high-dose fentanyl kind of dogma before, and I think that's very important to break down those kind of cultures that arise.
Monty, I'm going to go ahead and open this up for you because I know we've had lots of conversations about cardiac ERAS, HPI, all of these topics.
So Nick, I'll start with you and take you back to St. George's, if that's okay, which I think in the United Kingdom we recognise as one of those places that were great drivers under David Bennett et al. About the use of the goal-directed concept. Now, if we go back to you being at St. George's, was that every day of the week in cardiac? Were the people walking the walk or just talking the talk?
No, I mean, what I did when I was the lead for cardiac intensive care, I realized that actually therapy in cardiac, post-cardiac surgery is all over the place. There's very little standardization. And we looked at what they were doing in non-cardiac surgery, and there's a whole host of publications about goal-directed therapy and the improvements for patients, reducing complications and reducing hospital stay. And we thought, the cardiac surgery intensive care community has to look at this, you know. Clearly, these guys are doing some great work. So I appointed, actually, one of our guys who'd redone mostly general intensive care training and persuaded him to come over to the dark side. And he set up a protocol, initially using a different monitor with stroke volume optimization, and also did a study which showed really convincingly the reduction in acute kidney injury. You know, when you target patients in the first 4 hours, trying to secure the hemodynamics, reducing hypotension. This is not with HPI or anything, this is just using a standard stroke volume monitor. And we just really built on that work, and we had a lot of fights with the surgeons about it, as everyone does, but they accepted it because they saw, because they assume if you're doing something like that, it means giving more fluid.
Right.
And as I said before, it doesn't. It often means giving less fluid, but it's about giving fluid at the right time, which I think is the key thing that you identified. And so it became established, it became accepted. You know, I used to talk quite a bit about it. And as you can see, it became one of the recommendations for the cardiac ERAS. And I think it's really important to have standardized protocols. Mm-hmm. And if you can do that, if you can convince your surgeons, because, you know, their names are up there with mortality. You have to convince them that it's a good thing for them and their patients. They understand that it is. And I think, you know, it's really about rolling this project out a bit more and developing it.
So we look at the sort of the trilogy of what we're trying to achieve with the hemodynamic optimization. You'd think in the cardiac world, where the patients are usually pretty well monitored, let's ignore cardiac output monitoring per se for a moment, but you've usually got right-sided, left-sided monitoring, an arterial line. In the operating room, you've probably got a transesophageal echo these days. Post-op, you've got transthoracic. But they deal very well, quite often, with the output from the heart, you know, the cardiac output components of it, and the pressure components of it. But from my biases, they don't necessarily deal with the total intravascular volume components of it. And I noticed, Gabor, in your algorithm, that was the post-op bit, that was the starting point, was to address that volume component of it. Could you expand on that?
Yes, yes, as you said, I think it's very important. But it's not just, there are two elements of it. One of them is the being protocolized and having the same approach for most of the straightforward cases, which can be nurse-driven, you know, same way delivered with goals. And the other one, yes, optimizing the fluid status. It's probably the easiest and, well, someone will shoot me, but probably the most less harmful way to optimize the patient is the first instance to give them fluid. As long as you've got safety standards where to stop, as long as you're not going to flood the patients. And we do have that in our protocol. So when they come in, the first thing that is nurse-led, actually, is optimize them with fluid boluses. And they know how to perform a fluid challenge properly, because that's one thing. They need a big cannula at 50 ml syringe, draw it up five times, deliver 250 of fluid bolus, and meanwhile, measure the stroke volume before, after, and calculate the difference between the two, and then mark it. And if the patient was fluid responsive with a certain threshold, then they carry on and do it until the patient is not fluid responsive anymore. So then at that stage, we assume that the patient is fluid optimized. So if they remain unstable, then first of all, they need medical attention. Secondly, we need another gadget to assess the situation.
So they're judging this, you, as I understand, you have your cardiac output monitor, your flow track monitor goes from beginning to end of the case.
Yes.
And when they've arrived and settled down in the critical care unit, that top end of that algorithm is fluid boluses to optimize stroke volume.
Yes.
And then you've got two breaks. You've got no more than 1.75 liters, I think it said.
But
you are still watching the CVP as well.
Yes, so you don't want to flood the right ventricle. You want to make sure that the right ventricle is comfortable handling the fluid. And also, there are patients who are constantly fluid responsive. We know them, the vasoplegic patients. Mm. And the necessary solution there is not going to be fluid all the time. So you have to have a stop point at one stage where medical attention is needed.
So there might be
more fluid
after
that, but that will be driven by a medical doctor who understands the scenario and the hemodynamics around the patient.
So success is that they've arrived back, they've had repeated or just a few fluid boluses, stroke volume is maximized, they're looking great, CVP has not gone up, or if it has gone up, it hasn't gone up much. Nick, is that still the same in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been pretty much established that CVP is not really a reliable indicator of perfusion now. And I think people did use it. And I remember, if I think back to my intensive care training at Barts, there's very tight algorithms about the change in CVP with fluid boluses. So we very much moved away from that. Certainly post-cardiac surgery, where, you know, the patient is maybe not fully synchronized with a ventilator, and we know that CVP is unreliable. But I think the more parameters you can measure and the way you can actually package them up. I mean, one of the things I like about HPI is that you have an accessible number, so you can have a nurse-directed therapy, a bedside nurse who can manage that, and it gives them a number, because nurses want a number and they want a treatment that they can give in response to that number, and this makes it easy for them. But you can peel back that layer and you have all these other parameters. For example, you have, you know, DPDT, you have stroke volume, you have a whole host of numbers that are used to form that number that the physician can then look at with their highly intellectual, physicianly intensive care minds. And I think particularly since we started using ECHO, we understand these numbers and what it means for circulation and the cardiac performance a lot more. So you can really integrate these into sort of quite a sophisticated clinical decision-making system. So I like those two kind of stages that you can use. And there's not so many other monitors that give you that. And HPI is as yet really untested. It's a very early stage in cardiac surgery, but I think it's a very interesting tool to work with into the future.
So the team at the bedside has, under the protocol, given 1.25 litres, for example.
Yeah.
Things are not going in the right direction. So CVP's gone up a tad. They're not warming up around the edges. There's a hint of acidosis. There's a little nudge of lactate there. And the urine output's not looking great. They call you back to be very clever. What do you do next?
Well, I mean, it depends where we are. If we have our stroke volume monitor, straightforward stroke volume, we look at, I mean, obviously, in cardiac surgery, there's a whole load of things you have to think. First of all, you always think, is there blood around the heart? Mm-hmm. You look at all those kinds of things. That's, I mean, you know, you should never let technology blind you to the sort of the bleeding obvious, if you like.
Basics.
Is the patient bleeding?
No,
you know?
Pun intended.
Yes.
But when we look at our fluid bonds, obviously that incorporates drain loss. It also, if you have a really good urine output, which they sometimes do, it also incorporates that. So it's not just fluid given, it's obviously fluid balance. When you've eliminated obvious causes, you start to then think about what's your circulation look like, what's your vascular tone look like. And that's quite a difficult thing to really understand. I mean, I did some work with mean filling pressures, which is really interesting, and that's not something you can easily measure. And then you've also got to think about your cardiac contractility. A lot of people just focus on cardiac contractility, but I think of more interest and a bigger problem in patients is what's their tone like, what does their circulation look like?
So are you going straight to those secondary screen variables, mm-hmm. or are you also potentially reaching for your point of care ultrasound as well? Where are you on that spectrum?
The thing with point of care ultrasound in post-cardiac surgery patients, sometimes the views are really quite mm-hmm. difficult for all kinds of reasons, you know, substernal air. So it doesn't always give you what you want. It tends to eliminate the bigger problems, you know, blood around the heart, really, really poor contractility. It tends to give you that. You don't necessarily want to put a transesophageal echo in patients because you've got to resedate them. There is a risk of harm. So I think having all these other variables available to try and make quite difficult decisions around patients' hemodynamics is quite valuable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll come to slide in 1 second, Gavin. Anything to add to that? Does that sound like your practice too?
No, I think we're moving towards to it. Let's put it this way. I mean, traditionally, all of our consultants are, you know, well echo trained and well trained to look after cardiac surgical patients in their own, you know, experienced, judgmental way. And the tools they use, not necessarily as just yet the artificial intelligence that we can utilize at the bedside, but certainly some of the numbers coming up on the screen is useful, yet to be determined whether is useful in cardiac surgery, post-op cardiac patients. And if they are, then they simplify many, many questions we're battling every day.
We have some Slido questions.
We do have some Slido questions. We'll get into those. This is from Guy Lubbock. Guy, thank you so much. The low compliance with HPI recommendation in Sessler's study shares a theme with failure to call for help when MER thresholds are reached. How do we do better? Nick, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the most difficult thing to change in medicine also always is culture. I think you have to explain to people what you're doing. You have to take people along with you. You know, I think it's very important to share with your nurses and really get them involved and engaged and explain how it may make a difference for patients. And people are often cynical about new technologies, but I think you have to clearly explain what you're doing.
Gabor, anything to add to that?
Protocolized care is always a two-edged sword, if you like. Mm-hmm. Of course, it simplifies things and it gives you the driving seat to a nurse or a less trained doctor at the bedside. So in my mind, the key is education here, and the key, how the protocol is written, where are the stop buttons mm-hmm. that makes you, makes the person who's in the driving seat to actually step back one and say, well, this is not working. I need to call for help here.
Yeah. Seems like compliance with protocols is usually just a lack of education and engagement within it. A lot of times it seems like. How has this impacted your use of PA catheters? They are rarely used in UK general ICUs, but are still used in our cardiac unit. Do you still use them? And if so, when? Gabor, I'll start with you.
I think we're one of the biggest centers in the UK using PA catheters at the moment, apart from the transplant centers. We do use a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. It's mainly the decision of the anaesthetist at the beginning of the case in the post-cardiac surgical population. The traditional approach of, you know, poor cardiac output, multiple valves stay. In intensive care, when they come, the high-risk patients still tend to have the PA introducer sheet in, so there's an option for us to float. And at the moment, this is our calibrated cardiac output monitor in our unit. So if we fail the non-calibrated method, and the patient on multiple agents, we actually step towards to PA catheter. Yeah. So we do use a lot.
Nick, what about you guys over there?
I mean, I love PA catheters. For me, it's the one constant in an ever-changing landscape. It's something actually you've always been able to rely on. I mean, clearly it's much more invasive and you select your patients and just people having routine cardiac surgery, you don't necessarily get PA cath. But it's something I always used to have a conversation with my general ICU colleagues about. But they, you know, if you're not doing enough, you don't really know how to use it. And the nurses and the trainees coming through don't really know how to use it. Because it's a very valuable tool, but you've got to use it quite a bit to know really what to do with it and how to use therapies with it.
So on that, Nick, the measurement of cardiac output on the right side of the heart using the technique that's deployed, either with the hot wire technique or cold bolus, is subject to a lot of potential errors in the cardiac setting. But that's, to me, that's part of the beauty of using it and understanding it well, is if you then have a, I know we call it a right-sided, left-sided measurement, but we know what we mean, is if our arterial line-derived cardiac output is giving us a very different number to our pulmonary artery catheter-derived cardiac output. That, to me, tells me there's something I need to go and understand. I don't say the boxes are wrong or the machines are wrong. Yeah. I think there's something going on here. Is that a kindred spirit, kindred thought process?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a clinician, you know, particularly you're working late into the night, you first of all got to look at all your monitors. You know, the first thing you've ever got to look at is my arterial line working properly? Is it damped? Actually, is it reflecting something in the circulation? Because you're measuring something at, you know, one particular individual point. Can you actually generalize that to your entire circulation? So you've always got to weigh these things up. And this is, it's the beauty of live physiology and critical care, I think. But to come back to your question, you don't get the same artifacts with the PA cath. And I think we've dropped off measuring our wedge pressures a lot because we know that the problems with that. But it still is the gold standard for cardiac output. And there's some interesting new technology coming, I think, along with the PA cath, which I, you know, we can talk about maybe sometime in maybe next year or whenever. But I think there's some really exciting developments we're likely to see in the near future.
Yeah. Real quickly, because we are going to wrap up the session, and just so you know, we've had a lot of conversations on Top Med Talk, so you can find some of the answers to some of these questions on there. So be sure to check those out. But this is from Ezram Lehman. Has explainable AI been applied to the HPI? If clinicians understood what the algorithm was seeing, would there be improved adherence to these recommendations? Gabriel, you're vehemently agreed.
Yes. this was one of the kind of conclusion of many of the studies, that it's a black box. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is a trust in it. As a clinician, you step into your OR, you step into your intensive care, and all of the sudden, machine tells you what to do. And that doesn't go down well, does it? Yeah. So if you understand as a clinician why the machine draws that conclusion, if it explains to you that it builds trust, mm-hmm. of course it does. It's probably important at the initial phase, while you learn each other, while you understand how, you know, the machine works. But yes, if it tells you how it drew the conclusion, it probably helps to understand why you need to do that step that it recommends.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or reject it.
Yeah. Last question, but tying it in. Great conversation. Thanks for taking the time. Question for Gabor. Thank you. Or I'm keen to hear more about the association between hypotension and AKI post-cardiac surgery. Now, we have to wrap up our session. This is one of those things on Top Med Talk. If you go into our search engine and type in AKI hypotension, you'll be able to find a ton of conversations just like this and learn more about. And I'm sure you're open to people reaching out to you as well.
Yes, of course. Very happy to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Cameron, I'm sorry we didn't get to your question. Hopefully you can reach out to our guests. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today here at EPOM Top Med Talk. We appreciate it. Hopefully we could continue these conversations in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Top Med Talk. Thanks for downloading Top Med Talk. Don't forget to subscribe via your podcatcher. Don't forget to check us out on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And also, don't forget, Top Med Talk is the broadcasting arm of EdPOM, evidence-based perioperative medicine. We'd love you to find out more about that. If you check out edpom.org, you can find low prices on some of the conferences we're organizing around the world. Many of them are virtual and don't even involve you leaving your own home. Check out edpom.org now.